Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve is in conversation with Hella Thorning-Schmidt, who from 2011 to 2015 served as the Prime Minister of Denmark, the first woman ever to hold that office. Since 2020, she has been co-chair of an independent oversight board for Meta, helping its social media sites, Facebook and Instagram, answer some of their most difficult questions around freedom of expression online. Today, Steve and Hella dive into questions of leadership, how to balance regulation and freedom in online spaces, and how creating a diverse workplace culture could actually play a role in solving bigger global problems.
So, Hella, hi. Thanks very much for joining me in the studio today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to see you. You've got a really interesting background, politics, international relations, business. So I wanted to start by getting your perspective on where we are in the world today. I mean, people, I think, are overwhelmed by all of the things that are going on, not just in business, but also at a geopolitical level as well. So what's your take? Are you an optimist?
I'm always an optimist. I always think that today will be better than yesterday. So I'm always an optimist. But I must say it is hard right now to be very optimistic. And I'm glad you start there because I don't think we can understand anything about ourselves, our time, the people we hire, the leaders that we want to be without understanding the time that we're in. And we are in a very difficult time. Globally, in Europe, for example, we had the all-out invasion of Ukraine by Russia. Mm-hmm. We are having border issues in Serbia. We had the Armenians that we never hear about in Nagorno-Karabakh being driven out of their country, 100,000 people just a month ago. And now, of course, on top of this, we had the terrible attack from Hamas on Israel and the following war that we are seeing unfolding now. And this is in a world where it wasn't peaceful to begin with. Mm-hmm. We have a critical situation between the US and China and many local conflicts and also an African continent where we thought that now there would be growth and there would be a middle class. But what we're actually seeing is that we have conflicts coming up again and also a demography in Africa that should be worrying us all. And on top of that, I'm sorry to say, we have the changes of climate change, which we are seeing very, very clearly now. We were always warned that this was what it was going to look like, but now we're actually seeing it. And that will, of course, mean that people will be fleeing their countries and their regions much more because it's simply untenable to stay where they are. So that means that the pressure from refugees and immigration will also grow in the coming years. So I am an optimist, but I also think there's so many things that are fundamentally changing how we live our lives right now.
I mean, you just listed, you know, numerous challenges to optimism there. So let me chuck two more at you, which is we've got also got the upcoming US and UK elections.
Yes.
So lots of concern there around perhaps election tampering. But it strikes me that one of the things that is lacking, and I'm interested in your perspective here, is any true leadership, whether it be at the business level or at the political level.
I think we always say that. We always say there's leadership lacking, and we always got like so-so political leadership because political leaders in democratic countries have to be elected every fourth or fifth year. So they also have to understand what the population want here and now, and they can't only think about big issues all the time. I speak from deep experience about working with leaders across the world. So in a democratic system, you will always have leaders who are very good sometimes and take leadership. And where you have moments where leadership is needed, it will be taken by leaders. But you also have leaders that have to cater to their electorate and go back a little bit. But if you look at the European Union, for example, I think in the European Union, we have managed to show leadership when things were really hard, mm-hmm. all the way through history, actually. And I do think that European leaders often come up as taking leadership. And the same is actually true for our American friends. I mean, I know there's been a lot of turmoil in the American system and is a lot of turmoil right now, but they also often come up as the true leader that we expect them to be. And we can only hope that they will take that leadership, particularly the Americans in the Middle East right now. They are so needed right now. And of course, there's a lot of volatility in the American system because we also don't know what's happening in the American election next year. So that is making everyone a little bit more confused and insecure that we can't count as we could in the old days on American leadership.
There's also an element of trust in that, isn't there? Because, you know, as a leader, and you know this more than I, but you have to instill this feeling of trust in the decisions that you need to take, whether that be around where to open a new power plant or indeed at a much more international level, you know, in terms of how you might deal, as you say, with the Chinese or indeed with a conflict such as we've got going on in the Middle East at the moment. How do you think leaders can instill that level of trust?
Trust is so important and is perhaps the biggest thing that we have to deal with in politics, in business, in any institution. And to add to our sad story of where we are right now, we are seeing new low levels of trust globally right now. There was a little spike during the pandemic where people started trusting their governments a little bit more, but trust is actually at a new low level globally. And that means that the default sentiment of most people will be lack of trust in all institutions. And by institutions, I mean the media, politics, NGOs, and business. So the trust is very, very low. The only good news that I have here, and that comes back to your question about business leadership, is that the only institution of these four that I mentioned here that is actually trusted by people is business. Mm-hmm. Trust has gone local, and that means that I trust my leader, I trust my CEO, I trust the newsletter that gets sent out for my company. Trust has gone very local. And with that change of trust, that I actually trust the people who lead me, also comes a new responsibility for business leaders. So when we talk about leadership, we should of course talk about politicians because they're there to lead, but let's also talk about business leaders because I actually believe that a lot of those issues we are talking about that are deep issues that we're so worried about has to be solved not only by politicians, but actually also by business leaders. So the next few years, I'm expecting business leaders, because the trust have gone their way, to step up even more and try to be part of all the changes that we want to be seeing.
And how can they specifically do that, Hella? Because if I think of, from a technology standpoint, you know, we've got an evolving landscape. We've got the EU working hard on the AI Act, for instance, in the UK. Things are slightly different, taking a slightly different perspective in Canada, similarly. But one of the things that strikes me across all of those different geographies is that you do have this, perhaps, from a political standpoint anyway, lack or gap in understanding of what some of these technologies might be able to do, and some business leaders that are being asked to consult on that, having some skin in the game, running some of the largest companies. Yeah. So how do we, you know, work our way through that little conundrum?
There are all these new technologies from, we have the Data Protection Act, then we have the Digital Service Act, then we'll have AI regulation also in the EU. And I think none of this regulation of all these new technologies can be done without true business engagement. I do the oversight of content on Meta platforms, Facebook and Instagram. Meta is doing a lot to moderate their content, but they have recognized, and that's why they have asked us as an independent group of people to help them do their oversight. So they are trying to say, we need help from outside, and that's where I come in. But you also have to have regulators to be part of this mechanism. So I think all these new things that are coming, AI, for example, you've got to have some basic regulation. I think most countries will end up having that. But the biggest burden will actually be on companies to use AI responsibly, to be ethical about what they're doing. I sit on a board where we're doing neuromarketing, where we're also using AI and neuroscience. And we can only do that in good conscience if we look at the ethical considerations we have to have around that. So all companies using AI have to live up to certain standards. It could be a human rights standard that they choose, like Meta has chosen. It could be other standards. But I think all companies who are part of this change need to think about ethical issues, human rights issues, and put that into their products and put that into their use of new tools, whatever it is. Like we always had to when there was new machines coming in an old, the old industrial factories. We also had to use these new machines in an ethical way so that people didn't get in harm's way, so that we had a healthy working environment, that people didn't breathe in things they shouldn't, that wasn't healthy for them. So all new technologies take a lot of social responsibility from all companies. And I think with AI coming in, there's a lot of new ethic responsibilities that we have to understand as well.
I would agree. Let's look, though, at something that's been around for very much longer than AI, and that's social media. You just talked about regulation. Social media is totally unregulated, might say.
Well, it is, and it actually isn't unregulated. And now we'll have the Digital Services Act in Europe, so that then it will be very regulated in the European Union. But I also think that any platform that publishes content have to make sure that they have content moderation, because I love free speech and I love that social media has given so many people agency and giving them a voice. But you also have to have a system where you take content down that can harm other people or put other people in harm's way or instigate violence. So that is the balance you have to find in social media. That's what I'm doing for Meta. Independently of Meta, we are trying to find that balance on their social media. But other platforms should also look into their content moderation and make sure that it's safe what is being put on social media. But now the European Union will regulate, and I think other regions will follow.
The European Union certainly is taking that aspect very, very seriously, yes, isn't it? And calling social media companies to account. And I think I would agree that that's another area where we have to see some form of regulation, if only because we talked earlier about trust and leadership. Interestingly, I think very many people turn to social media for that leadership, because they trust it.
Yes.
And there is that real
but
difficult issue.
But we also have, again, all these things are balanced. People say, oh, we should just have more regulation in this space. But what we really do not want is a system where governments can decide what people can post on social media. Mm-hmm. And bear in mind that more and more people live in countries that are not democracies and will in the future as well. More and more people will live in not democracies. Any autocratic leader will feel it's a God's gift if they can start regulating what people can write on social media. So we don't want governments to be too heavily involved in regulation of social media, and we don't want companies not to take responsibility for what they're doing. So again, we have to find a mixture between companies being responsible, regulators regulating in the right amount, and perhaps also independent bodies like what I am doing, mm-hmm, that can be part of this discourse about what should be allowed on social media. And I will tell you one thing, I do this every day, and it is not easy to find out what should be allowed on social media platforms or not, because one person's free speech can harm another person, and that's the balance you have to find.
So how do you find that balance, Helen?
We look at the platform's own community standards, right, and then we put human rights on top of that. So we look at human rights that is established by the UN and the law that has followed there, and then we try to find the right balance. But when it is difficult is, what can you post in a conflict situation? What can you post right now? We have the situation in the Middle East. What should be allowed to post about a designated organization like Hamas, for example? What can you post? How can you praise such an organization? So this is really difficult. And of course, Meta has standards, and I believe they have fairly good standards, but there's also vast, so much content to moderate, but they do need help to try to take more principled decisions about what should be posted and what should be removed.
Right, let's switch now and look specifically at the security industry. It's an industry that is, in my opinion, continuing to evolve exceptionally rapidly. But one of the challenges that it faces is the lack of skills. Mm. And indeed, we see that very clearly in diversity. So the average, if you look at most organizations, security departments, of proportions of women versus men are clearly out of line with where they would ideally be. You're in, again, a somewhat unique position in that you were the first woman to serve as a Prime Minister of Denmark and also leader of the country's Social Democrat Party. So what are some of the insights that you can bring into how you can operate effectively as a woman, based on your experience, to really try to break down some of these barriers in what is a hugely male-dominated environment?
Yeah, I like to turn it around, because I'm not sure that women has to give the explanation of how you can operate in a system. I do think that we are now at a stage, for many different reasons, where we have to ask, how can the traditional labour market open itself up to new and more diverse candidates. Mm-hmm. And that's not only because it's nice to say that you're doing it, but in the search for talent in the future, I do think that everywhere has to change. They have to change their values. They have to change how they are. Because the next generation, I've got kids as well who are in their mid-20s, and the next generation, they are so different from what I was like when I entered the labor market. And they have very certain characteristics. The next generation, millennials and Gen Z, they will not work for a company that they don't trust, that they don't believe that they have the good values, where they don't trust the CEOs, where they don't see behavior backing those values in their everyday lives. So in order to attract new talent, companies have to change. Mm-hmm. And that means that the next step of this in the other generations, my own generation, we were so happy to get access to the labor market, so we didn't question anything. If they said, sit there and do that, we did it. We were like so happy to get a job. Mm-hmm. That's what we did. But the next generation, they'll come in and say, why are you sitting like this? Do something different, organize things differently. They'll ask questions. And with them, they will actually take the other workers because, or the other people working there, because they have such a strong voice. So now we're in a situation that workplaces need to change to invite diversity candidates in. And that means that all of us who are here, who are white, who are male, who are privileged females like myself, we have to ask ourselves the question, how can we change to invite more people in? And that means looking at our own privilege, looking at our own bias, looking at all the things that we thought we understood that we might have to understand in a new way again, ask new questions, invite young folks in, understand, invite women in, of course, and then be good allies for the change. So I think there was a long time where we thought that women could come in and then they individually could try and change how we saw things. But now I actually think that the burden has changed and it's the majority culture that has to try and change to invite new folks in and also be welcoming when we then enter. I think it was hard to be a woman in a male-dominated world. I was the first woman to become leader of my party, stand on the shoulders of many, many men before that, and of course the first woman to become prime minister. And there's a lot of things you have to break through and it gets tiring. And I would have loved if someone could have help me a little bit. And that's what I think we have to do now. I have to help young women achieve what they want to do, which I'm doing. But everyone has to help diversity candidates settle in the labor market to make them feel welcome, hire them, always have women and diversity candidates in interviews, make them feel welcome when they're here. We have to do the job.
I'm glad you broadened it out to look at it from a diversity perspective. One of the challenges that people quite often talk to me about is that blend. You've talked a lot about bringing younger or more diverse elements into the labour market. Once they're in the company, that's where a lot of people tell me they then have problems because they have such this generational mix.
Yeah.
Right the way, and everybody behaves in a different
yes.
way. And the challenge I think that leaders and chief executives have in that instance is, yes, we want to encourage the diversity element, but we also don't want to lose some of the people that we've brought with us.
No.
Now, the argument that I would put forward is that is diversity.
Yeah.
It's as broad as that. So you shouldn't be looking at it specifically as to how do I encourage this one versus that one. But that's very easy to say and, of course, very difficult to do. Any advice for people in that
area?
It
is very difficult to do. And in the future, we won't only have two generations in the labour market. We'll have three generations. And we have to understand how they are working with each other. But I do think that we had a time where the elders ruled the world. Middle-aged white men ruled the world. And that is gone now. And we have to realize that and also try to find a way to broaden our thinking. It is very, very comfortable to be with people that you know. I know that from myself. People are very happy and in their safe space when there are people that they can relate to. If they got the same skin color, if they have the same religion, if they do the same, put on their lycra on the weekend, go on their bikes. If we have the same interest, it is very easy and very comfortable. So we all have to accept that in order to engage new people and be a diverse workspace, we need to come out of our comfort zone and actually welcome that diversity. And what I believe, and that's why I think the workplace is such a fantastic place, business have trust, they have responsibility. I know so many business leaders who are trying so hard to live up to that responsibility. You have invited me today to talk about this and challenge you. So many people are trying to do this. And what research also shows is that the workplace can be a great place to build bridges. Mm-hmm. Bridges between people who are very different, bridges between people of different generations, bridges between people who hate woke and people who are woke. So business and the everyday life that we have with each other in the workplace can actually be a place to build bridges. And people even talk about in the American system, which is so divided mm-hmm. politically and culturally and everything, that the workplace will be the last bastion of a place where you can still talk to each other,
right.
Where you can actually still say, should we go for a coffee or should we do this and that, where you can still have that kindness, that politeness that binds us together in the workspace and still talk to each other, because it's still fun to go to work and we enjoy working together and we love to be in a team. And that is a spirit that could perhaps even take the conversation above and beyond the workplace. So the workplace could be the bridge, but that also demands a lot of future leaders. And no leader, wherever they are, will be free of this obligation. So everyone has to engage.
I think that's a nice way of linking right the way back to the way we started, Hella, where we mentioned that maybe it is going to be businesses that begin to emerge as sorting out some of the problems that we've just been talking about. It's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing some of those insights. Thank you, Hella.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to today's guest, Hella Thorning-Schmidt, ISF member listeners. Be sure to log into ISF Live to access all of our comprehensive research, reports, and tools related to this conversation. And to our listeners who haven't yet become an ISF member, get in touch with your regional representative at securityforum.org/join. We'll be back with a new episode next week. In the meantime, if you would take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening, give us a 5-star rating and write a quick review, we'd be grateful. You can also listen to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org. which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod, music by Alexander Filipiak. Thanks for listening.